The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Michael LaFlemme.
This is science, just as much as standard physics and chemistry is quote-unquote science. Well, there's a science of the mind that has not been sufficiently explored for historical reasons, and nothing less. Doesn't mean it's fake. It just means that we have chosen a paradigm that categorically rejects that, and that's it.
Visions of Atlantis, reclaiming our lost ancient legacy. This is something that you're going to spend hours with, whether it's, you know, from dawn to dusk for the next 6 weeks, or maybe 24 hours like one person did, and I'm so in awe. Michael LaFlemme, the author, you touched a nerve with this. This is fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much, Wendy. Yeah, and as you mentioned, it is a dense book, a lot of rich research, and so I was quite surprised when the person I was, you know, just loosely acquainted with told me that he actually read it in one day, I think on a weekend after work or something. And, you know, that really makes me happy because I really tried to take all this information that was so very complicated story and can be presented as such. And I've seen that in a lot of books. And I really wanted to just synthesize a lot of different information using my own unique perspective, but also write in a kind of, you know, Ken Burns documentary tone where I'm more of like your guide to all this difficult information. And I've tried to structure it in a way where it really does read not just like a catalog of historical facts, like a lot of books on this subject, but a story, you know, that can be read as if you were reading, you know, a thriller novel or something like that. So I thought that was really nice.
I would compare it to War and Peace, okay? If you're talking...
okay.
What was the other one? 1,000 years or something. These are big, long, intense books. Now, the thing is, and the reason it's so intense, you go from the philosophers, you from Plato to the Native Americans. This has got the whole thing, and channelers with Edgar Cayce, and somebody I had no idea about, which I had to go look up. Frederick Spencer Oliver, A Dweller on Two Planets. Yeah. That is amazing with that connection in this work.
Well, that's a really, truly bizarre character, Frederick Spencer Oliver. And, you know, the few people that have reviewed his work seriously, you know, even they stand kind of in awe, even if they consider his work, you know, one of an imagination of, you know, a 17-year-old kid writing in 1886 on the, you know, at the closing of the American frontier in California from a mining community near, you know, Mount Shasta. But his book, A Dweller on Two Planets, you know, it began, according to him in his preface, as a, you know, what we would call clairaudience, which, you know, as opposed to clairvoyance, he was receiving, in his words, you know, messages kind of subliminally, or he was hearing voices, it's not quite clear, and beginning these automatic writing sessions to the tune of, I think, 2 to 3 pages a day, you know, and that's a really long book, longer than my book. You know, you want to talk about dense, I mean, that book is so difficult, really, I think, to read, because not just it's written in, you know, 19th century English, but it's written, in his words, you know, he's telling the story of this person called Philos, who is using Oliver to tell his own past life story as a character named Zeom Numenos in the island of Poseid in the culture of Atlantis in the year 11,160 BC. Now, you could say, okay, this kid just read, you know, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which came out, you know, 15 years before him, or, you know, he was influenced by whatever other science fiction, which really there wasn't much like we think of it today. But that doesn't explain, you know, for example, as I cite extensively, his theories of chemistry, his theories of the sun, his theories of physics, his theories of the entire Atlantean religion as he understands it, Atlantean philosophy. I mean, these if they were added by, you know, a secret contributor, which again is highly unlikely because we know the chain of custody was, you know, his mother took these notes after he died at the age of 33 in 1899, and she just sat on them for another 6 years, eventually published it in a small press, but it really didn't get out to the world until 1920. Very few people made money off of this until much later. And so the motive isn't there if this is fiction. And what he says is incredible, you know? And so I really spent a lot of time, I think more than any book I've ever seen, certainly on this topic, trying to collate all of the things he said into a kind of coherent philosophy and worldview, and then comparing that against actual scientific, geological, philosophical, and historical sources, along with other Chandler's accounts that came before, or rather after in the case of Chandler's, and seeing if what he said, you know, made any sense, or if it was actually just pure fiction. And what I found, to my great surprise, was almost everything he said was later discovered to be the case, particularly with his theories of catastrophism, how the Grand Canyon was formed. You know, he says, I mean, this is in 1886. This is a kid who's never left the United States, to my knowledge. And he's talking about how the grass or the rivers and the dikes that used to exist in the Amazon, that used to crisscross the Amazon basin, you know, and how the Atlanteans had actually gone to the Amazon basin at that time and transplanted all sorts of plants and actually had brought agriculture to that region. Now, this was not even known until, you know, or confirmed rather, until, you know, very recently when a team went down there and said, you know, there is evidence that plants have been, you know, cultivated in the Amazon, which probably was a huge agricultural garden approximately 10,000 BC. So it's like, that's one of about 10 different things I found that seemed to add up. And, you know, what particularly struck me about that book was his explanation of, you know, the high technology of Atlantis, which a lot of people after him had always made the case of, you know, they had this, they had flying ships, they had crystal technology, they perhaps had even ventured into space. But he's really the first in my, you know, 7 years of research to propose a high technology Atlantis. I think as an intellectual historian, as I was trained, that's where that angle really begins. And it's not fantastical. It's actually very believable because he explains how the ships work. He explains the power sources they use. And I found it fascinating, you know. And really that book to me was a fascinating addendum to the account of Plato, because they're both talking about the same principal islands of, you know, Poseidon, I would argue. In Plato's account, he just says Atlantis, but he says it was a archipelago and military empire centered on one main island with others surrounding it. And in Frederick Oliver's account, he's talking about, alternatively, Atlan, Atoll, Atlantis, but he's saying, I lived on the main island of Poseidon. And of course, in Plato's account, there's a circular city in the center of which is the statue of Poseidon surrounded by the Nereids. And in Oliver's account, he talks about sailing around the capital city, which he calls Kyphel, and it has a circular river, the Nomus River, and, you know, his time there. So I think they're actually talking about the same thing. And really a kind of key breakthrough for me was, in Plato's account, people give him a lot of slack because they say, well, there's nothing special about this. This is just a Bronze Age culture that Plato put in the mid-Atlantic on an island. Maybe it has some nice megalithic architecture, but it's nothing that's so extreme that it couldn't, you know, have been built, and it's just Plato's imagination. Plato's not talking about flying ships and crystals and lasers and things like this. In Oliver's account, he says, by the time this person that I'm channeling's past life had ended around 11,100 and, you know, roughly 60 or 50 BC, he says, over the next 800 years, bringing us closer to 10,300, the society had devolved into a more primitive form that it had, you know, before all the high technology. And he said that the leadership had basically given up on the people, you know, absconded to some kind of, you know, etheric realm and almost a transhuman angle in this, where it was just basically a bunch of, you know, elites that had gone away to their version of Davos and decided to just leave humanity as this kind of barbaric remnant. And some of them even converting themselves into just pure energy or merging with, you know, I guess the cloud or however you want to think about it, because he doesn't have obviously the language to really explain these difficult things that he's trying to channel. And so for me, it makes sense, because in the end of Plato's account, you have these seafaring people on triremes that begin to invade the Mediterranean, you know, and that's the account that Solon is told by the Egyptians, was, you know, your nation, Solon, you know, Athens, were the ones that defeated the powers of Atlantis and saved the Mediterranean from slavery. But that makes sense, because in Oliver's account, at the last, you know, few centuries before the destruction, they become this barbaric race of people who are doing human sacrifice, who have lost touch, he says, with how to even use, you know, the phones that he describes, the holographic technology, the ships. And so for me, it actually was a missing piece to the story.
You're a history professor, and so that part of it, I think, is what adds more credibility to this, because you've done your due diligence, you've tried to connect the dots, you would do it as somebody who is an educator would, and try to lead us from point A to point B, where if I do something, I get lost in the circles and off on a tangent very quickly. And you are very good at being linear. So as we follow it along, though, the thing that you have done is bring so much depth to it. What caught you about this story to start out with? Because I don't know that, you know, that isn't where everybody automatically goes, because they've tried to debunk this for years. So what brought you into it?
Well, you know, it's really strange. I, like most people, you know, since I was a kid, growing up in South Florida, you know, by the ocean, by the Atlantic Ocean, next to Atlantic Boulevard. You know, most people, I think, are exposed to that word, Atlantis. And, you know, when you're kids, they put it in cartoons and things like this. And, you know, for the most part, most people just think it's, you know, just that. Nothing more than, you know, a nicer version of the Little Mermaid or something like that. Or maybe today they think it's a branch of the Aquaman, you know, Marvel, DC Comics universe. And I really didn't care about this topic whatsoever. I had obviously been exposed to it teaching Plato, and, you know, I just looked at it like another myth or something that was a foundational story, or maybe more like Gilgamesh or even the Aeneid, where they talk about the Trojan War, which, you know, we know now that Troy is real. But I had never given much thought to it, because I was just busy teaching, you know, ancient history or modern history and things like this. But for some reason, one day, I really have no idea. I mean, I had kind of my own Frederick Oliver moment, where just sitting in a park, and I felt like two things happened. One, I was just immediately flooded with all this information that really was bizarre, and I couldn't quite explain it even. I remember my girlfriend thinking, like, are you okay? And like, I don't know. And then this kind of almost hypnotic suggestion to investigate. And as I started to read, you know, secondary accounts like the Antediluvian World or the story of Atlantis, these 19th century, super dense, you know, sometimes like theosophical accounts of it, I was like, wait a minute, you know, there's an actual, you know, transatlantic cross-cultural linkage between these cultures that, you know, perhaps Atlantis could explain. And over the first year, probably, I stuck just to theological sources or books that had attempted to debunk this, and took those very seriously, as I still do, you know, trying to be an objective person. But I started to see that there was too much to this for it to be pure fiction. And as I plugged in the story and was just kind of trying to figure it out for myself with notes that I would take or things on my computer, bookmarks, I used to have probably 500 bookmarks that looked like a crazy person, like a crime scene investigator or something, I realized there were missing pieces that I really was just kind of, as a curious person became obsessed with filling in. Like, okay, if this was real, then it existed. But how do I access that when we only have a handful of reliable historical accounts of this time? You can only read the Plato account so many times before you just go, all right, this sounds like ancient Greece or Bronze Age Greece. It doesn't sound anything, you know, fantastical, even though he puts the date at 9,600 BC, roughly. So it became these clairvoyant visions that filled in so much of the detail and kind of added the color to Plato's, you know, I'm not going to say totally dry account. It's much more detailed than most people realize for it to be pure myth. I mean, he's describing the dimensions of the city, the colors of the buildings, the specific temples. It's not just there was an island in the middle of the Atlantic that was wonderful, like most people think. When I got into Frederick Oliver and then Edgar Cayce and then Barbara Hand Clow and Phyllis Schlemmer's versions of this time period through channelings and automatic writing and corroborated all of them, which took me 3 years working every day to do, it absolutely fell into place. To the point where I actually was, you know, quite uncomfortable because I realized that unequivocally the evidence does suggest, and I'll say that much, that this reality did exist. And in fact, it existed, and in many ways, you know, if we continue and we survive over the next few thousand years, we will be right back to where these people probably were, you know. That's kind of how I came to this, you know, point where I turned all these notes into, you know, a 400-page book.
See, there's no way.
So I don't know.
you just fell into this because when you're saying 3 years to do that, and then all of a sudden the dots connect. But the fact that you
did,
you're bringing new information and connecting the dots in a different way. The Native American aspect that you go into, we're just now finding out with the mound builders that some of these, what should I call them, buildings, the kinds of things that they created are actually older than the pyramids. That's brand new knowledge. And so, you know, to finally get some kind of a scope of how ancient our world religions, our world ideologies, our societies I don't think we even know. We're still discovering stuff now.
That's interesting if you mention the Native Americans, because, you know, that's really the last place people look when they are looking for clues of, you know, Atlantis. But if you read the Edgar Cayce readings, if you read all 500 of his transcripts roughly on this subject out of the 14,300 readings he gave in his life, he specifically says regarding the Iroquois tribe, he says the Iroquois tribe are direct descendants of the people of Atlantis. He says the people of Atlantis originally, culturally, were the people that became the Native Americans of North America. Even though the culture was international, global, and culturally mixed with people from Northern Europe, people from India, people from China, people from Egypt, Africa, all interacting in this globally connected culture. But he says the Native Americans were the original Atlanteans, and they were the ones in possession of high technology at its peak. And so, I mean, it's the opposite, really, of what we think today is that, you know, it was, and nothing against them, you know, but it's like this idea that Europeans were, you know, the inheritors of wisdom that came from the Middle East. And basically they were, that's the Garrett Diamond Guns, Germs, and Steel, you know, the New York Times bestselling thesis, is that it was the Europeans who were the supreme technological power in history, and everybody before them, you know, the people that led up to Europe bringing technology through military means and spreading it across the world, and then the scientific revolution, the Enlightenment, et cetera. But if you look at Cayce's account, no, it was in fact the Atlanteans, aka Native Americans in a variety of, you know, different iterations, that were the people that had achieved the highest point of technology, you know, and lived just like today with various other groups in different levels of progress. You know, it wasn't just like Atlantis and everybody else. It was, you know, native peoples that, just like today, live in the Amazon, and then we have, you know, the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, and those are in the same timeline right now. And so it was back then. And basically his world, as he describes it, is just, it's today, using instead of internal combustion technology, crystal technology, you know, and instead of using the kind of Edison Rockefeller electrical model, using what Tesla was probably about to release had he not been suppressed and railroaded by the powers that be that saw how much money was to be gained through this sticking to fossil fuels. So it's kind of interesting because to me it's like, it's the early 20th century. We probably could have been by this time, 100 years later, closer to the world that Frederick Oliver and Casey had envisioned had we gone down that Tesla, you know, energetic view of the world. And in fact, Tesla himself got a reading from Edgar Casey, allegedly. The name is redacted, but a lot of reliable people think that that indeed happened. And it makes sense because many famous people got readings from Edgar Casey, including Henry Ford, Woodrow Wilson, Harry Houdini, thousands of other people, doctors, lawyers, all sorts of people. And apparently Tesla was told he was a reincarnated person from this time. And that's why he had all this innate knowledge that was so ahead of his time, which is a theme that Casey frequently, you know, reinforces, that groups of people, soul groups, reincarnate at specific junctures in human history, and they bring with them, you know, the knowledge. And it's interesting because I include a quote from the person who's least expect to believe in this, and which is Henry Ford, who, you know, most people would think, oh, this is just some square industrialist guy. But Henry Ford and many people from Henry Ford's executive business team in the 20s and 30s got personal past life readings from Edgar Casey directly. Henry Ford was told, well, you know, you actually played a minor role in 10,500 BC as an Atlantean king named Ajax Ol, who traveled to Giza right around the time of the final destruction, and you built one of the inner passageways of the pyramid. And Henry Ford himself said, I learned about reincarnation when I was 26, and it put me at ease because now I realize all these skills I learned to build Ford Motor Company were the inheritance of multiple generations and lives of accruing knowledge. You know, so I thought that was another interesting aspect to the story, you know, because it's not just a book about Atlantis. It's really like a alternate story of life, using Atlantis as a kind of focal point, but branching off at times into, like, what is a soul? What is reincarnation? Is there evidence of clairvoyance that can be supported by, you know, traditional conventional evidence? And indeed, I found there was.
I'm attaching a video. It links the timeline at 12,000 BC for an ancient civilization, which puts it in a context that dovetails the Atlanteans and gives it more prehistory legitimacy. So I'll tag that. Visions of Atlantis, Reclaiming Our Lost Ancient Legacy. Michael LaFlemme. We'll continue after the break.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Visions of Atlantis, Reclaiming Our Lost Ancient Legacy, Michael LaFlemme. There's part of this story I think is fascinating. It has to do with a discovery in the Grand Canyon.
In this episode, which is a very fascinating read, they say something that really caught my attention, which is, you know, they saw evidence of these brass, copper, tempered tools that were super sharp, and that they saw evidence of, you know, smelting and iron working.
Okay, that's a preview. We'll revisit that.
Kincaid, this is a mind-blowing story. You want to tell that one?
I'll start in reverse and say that I will describe the story. That's one that I have a 50-50. I'll give it 50-50% credibility, you know, being honest. It's a fascinating story, and it came out, I think, in 1909 in the Arizona Gazette. And it's a story of a guy, you know, Mr. Kincaid, who's sailing down the, I think it's the Green River in the Grand Canyon, and he sees an opening in the side of the cliff, parks his boat, goes ashore, goes in here, and then finds this essentially cave temple complex with Egyptian and Tibetan reliefs including, you know, tombs and basically a picture of a Buddha sitting on a pedestal holding two cactuses with images of good and evil. And the Arizona Gazette, I think, printed this, you know, like I said, in 1909, and was known at the time as a kind of sensational, almost like a National Enquirer type newspaper. And a lot of debunkers say, well, look at the stories that came out in that same article, you know? And I list those in bold like they did, which is like, you know, nitroglycerin plant explodes, or, you know, Japanese or Navajo Indian on rampage and things like this. And so I give them credibility. But what's really interesting is in that story, if that is a hoax, okay, if that is a hoax, because Kincaid was never interviewed or tracked down in posterity, and the Smithsonian denies that I think it was a Mr., I forget the name, whoever they allegedly sent, they deny having anything to do with it. Officially, the Smithsonian was contacted, and they said, we never went there. But the Smithsonian says a lot of things, that,
yeah,
particularly about the skeletons of giants that they claim they never destroyed and found. So I believe also the Smithsonian emblem is nearly identical to one of the main Jesuit emblems, so I wouldn't trust them as far as I could throw them. But that's another story.
That's another book.
Right, yeah, that's another book. But remember, one of the founding tenets of Jesuitism, you know, was we can make people think black is white and white is black. So, and as somebody who has worked for the Jesuits at Loyola University in Chicago, I'll go on record as saying that's true. But in this episode, which is a very fascinating read, they say something that really caught my attention, which is, you know, they saw evidence of these brass, copper, tempered tools that were super sharp. And that they saw evidence of, you know, smelting and iron working, which was interesting because in a non-controversial case from Lake Superior, Michigan, which has been confirmed, you know, there are over 5,000 unexplained copper mines that date back 3,000 plus BC, which Gavin Menzies, who's a very mainstream, I would argue, non-controversial historian, has even said, we don't have enough Bronze Age artifacts to account for how many tons of copper were mined from the Lake Superior region. And in those accounts, they say, we found copper and brass tempered instruments that had Phoenician markings on them. So right there, it's like, well, what are the Phoenicians doing in Lake Superior in 3000 BC? In this case, it said the same, very similar thing. Now, I don't think anybody has ever found this, and this is one of the few, you know, things I can, I think, unequivocally say. Just by accident, I did a full scan for a week of the Edgar Cayce Reading Archive through an application, and it's painstaking. I don't recommend it. You know, that's why the book is $20. Yes. It saves you the trouble of doing it. And what's unbelievable is that in one reading, he's giving a past life for a woman, and he says, you know, you used to be a emissary from India. And now he didn't say Indian. He said from the Far East, or the country now known as India. And you came to the plains of Arizona, where this story that we're just talking about took place. And he says, you were responsible for bringing Eastern wisdom and showing the people the various methods of using the clays and the metals. And it was called the Hapapulpit people. And they made the temples in the cave. And I'm like, I have to put this in, because that's an astoundingly specific thing, and it's literally what this article that everybody thinks is fake said. I don't know. I did a few follow-up investigations, and I found some blogs where, you know, again, take it with a grain of salt. I don't trust too many things I read on blogs, but apparently there are a group of people that claim to have, you know, gotten closer to finding this entrance, which is in a very remote, dangerous to access part, and also you're not even allowed to enter that part of the Grand Canyon. It's protected. So you couldn't even do legitimate archaeological research without a permit, and I doubt you would ever get that permit because it's a national park now. So it's like, personally, I think it's true. Was it embellished? Did Kincaid exist? I don't know.
What I also think is interesting is the name that you gave, also the Havasupai Native Americans, that tribe, the I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but the Havasupai.
I think I called it Hapapulpit is how he wrote it, how his stenographer wrote it, like Hapapulpit people. Right.
Yeah. And it's just interesting that there that is a close correspondence to those, you know, the language, period. It's interesting.
Wait, hold on. Hold on a second. You're saying that there is a tribe there named the Hapapulpit people?
Havasupai. The fact that similar.
I was not aware of that. I will add that in a quick revision.
Addendum,
this week.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Havasupai. I just think that's interesting because the names are very similar. And when you're doing any kind of telepathy, channeling, intuition, it's easy to get the names close, but not quite. You know?
No, and you know, also, there's only one recording of Edgar Cayce speaking where you can decide what he's actually saying. And it's a medical reading. Out of the 14,000, there's one that's publicly accessible without requesting a special recording from the archives. You're absolutely right. Like, his stenographer was responsible for typing things, and she even makes notes a lot of times, like, is this how you spell it? Like, I don't know. Maybe I have to ask him. And sometimes he tells her, but other times it's like maybe he said something different and you have to just go by what she wrote. So I always think that's incredible. I mean, if you can find an affinity that's that close, like what you just told me, I mean, that's an astoundingly accurate similarity. I always get this wrong. I forget if it's the Mahabharata or Ramayana or Vishnu Purana, but one of these ancient Indian Sanskrit texts that I cite mentions, just to touch on the linguistic similarity that I found, they mention a 10-year war that's not clear if it's between them and this island or just they're describing a 10-year war on this island, but they mention an island called Atalia. And they put it at basically where the Canary Islands are right now. And they say after this 10-year war, these group of people were destroyed in the island sank. If you go to the Canary Islands on Google Maps, well, there's a city there today called La Atalaya, right where the Sanskrit text said there was an island called La Atalia that became La Atalaya. And on, I make these claims where if I can show strong correlations between things that could not be incidental, well, then.
The thing that convinced you this was real, what was it?
For me, the thing that convinced me that this was real was just the recurrence of these dates, that all of this information seemed to fall into the period between 12,000 BC, roughly 9,600, 9,500 BC. From Plato's account to Edgar Cayce's account, who had never read Plato, to Frederick Oliver's account, to geographical evidence, cultural evidence, genetic evidence, that some cataclysm certainly happened at that point. If you look at the history of the world and you collate all this data, that does indeed seem to be the time when something big went down. And the rest of the information fills in the gaps of what happened before that. But I think at this point, particularly with the findings at Göbekli Tepe, which has been dated to roughly 10,000 plus BC, you cannot deny that there was an advanced culture that, in some cases, parts of that culture were aware through astrology and astronomy. And in Edgar Cayce's account, from messages received from an interdimensional portal with either extraterrestrials or interdimensional spirit beings, that this cataclysm, this earth-ending thing was coming. And I think that's why we have so many stories of the same thing from all over the world.
On the reviews, the editorial reviews, you've got some outstanding comments. I'm hoping that you're going to get some more reach for this because it's a dynamite compilation of things that all relate to Atlantis. And I'm so glad that you were hooked because your passion definitely comes through in this.
Oh, well, thank you. And, you know, to me as a historian, you know, it actually makes more sense. Like, I always find it funny when people go, like, the debunkers and all these so-called debunkers, some of which are very intelligent, others are just, you know, ignorant, and I respect them accordingly. And I really mean that. It's good to have people question, you know, each other, but it's not good when that becomes an ideology that's precluding the inclusion of information that is so obvious and evident that if it were applicable to the ancient Greeks or the ancient Egyptians or the ancient, you know, Amazonian tribes, we would admit and say, look, we just found this, because it fits into a very cookie cutter paradigm that has existed for the past 150 plus years of so-called professionalized history, you know, which I would argue began in the 19th century. But it's not helpful, because the official story of humanity is that anatomically modern humans in variety of different species have existed at least conservatively for 200,000 years. And we are told nothing happened in the first 190,000, and then really not much happened until the last 5,000. That, to me, on the surface is absurd. But with this story, you know, where Edgar Cayce places the first iteration of early Atlantean society at 200,000 BC, which again is an interesting date, since according to Rice University, that's exactly when mitochondrial Eve, the woman we're all supposedly descended from, is said to have existed. Which, I mean, he said that in 1932, I believe, before DNA was even invented. So again, these are impossibly good guesses if he's just guessing. These clairvoyant visions fill in this time period that I call the dead zone in chapter two, you know, which we can't explain, so we say nothing happened, you know. And that's not even my original thought. That was actually said in the 16th century, I believe, by a French secretary to a prince, Isaac Laferrere. And he said, look, I've read the Chaldean record. I've read the Egyptian record. They say history is vastly longer. But you people, through your ignorance, just say nothing happened here. And you fill in a place on a map and you just put an X through it, or you keep it black, because you don't know, so you think that's actually true. And I think that was a really important observation he made, you know, 500 years ago, because we're still doing it today.
Yeah.
We don't have records of how the pyramids were built, which we do not. There is no record, as Ivan Petrushevich says, it specifically describes that. Now, you would think there would be a blueprint if dynastic Egyptians under Khufu, that fantasy story, built that structure. You'd also think there would be more than a inscription found by a 19th century explorer, Howard Weiss, who had no witnesses when he discovered this, so he could have written it himself, that says Khufu, and he spelled it wrong. And we say, well, that's Khufu that built it. You know what I mean? It's like if somebody found the Empire State Building, Wendy, in 5,000 years, and they saw Starbucks, that's like saying, oh, Starbucks built this. It's like, are you kidding me? That's what you're using to write history books and say that this is the tomb of Khufu? It's important, I think, to me, the book as a historian, it's kind of my, you know, this subject is the way that I explore just not just the meaning of life, reincarnation, but how history is written, you know, because if this is actually the default civilization that humanity has lived in, but it was utterly destroyed and been 10,000 plus years since it existed, well, then we're missing a major part of the picture. And that's why I call the book, you know, Visions of Atlantis, because it's like, it's not just the story of Atlantis, but it's a vision for the future, you know, because if this world indeed existed, as Frederick Oliver described, it wasn't perfect, but it's certainly more interesting and advanced and in some cases, you know, peaceful than this thing we call civilization today, which I think we can all agree is far from perfect, you know. I'm looking at my epilogue, you know, we still must grapple with compelling geological data, anomalous oceanic discoveries in the mid-Atlantic and elsewhere, oddly distant and inexplicable language commonalities, demonstrable archaeological evidence of advanced construction, and geoproportional, astronomically inclined, aligned, precise megalithic architecture in Egypt and the world over. Add to this the 100-plus documented flood myths and numerous independent source channelings of the same period, describing similar themes from people who never directly collaborated, however you personally feel about admitting such as evidence, and perhaps Plato was telling a version of the truth as he understood it. I see no reason to write all of this off wholesale because it doesn't gel with the mainstream take on antiquity, which presents next to nothing when asked to produce the story of the human condition before the accepted rise of civilizations in the Fertile Crescent and the remotest official periods of ancient China and India. Rather than lambasting those merely seeking a possible explanation for the mysterious and deeply enriching potential epoch of the human story, while arranging the debate in the stark terms of obscurantism and fringe history versus the shining light of official history and the truth, or bitching about which researcher discovered what and how that couldn't possibly be, we might pause and ask ourselves how exactly it is we believe tomorrow will turn out. After all, Edgar Cayce claimed the souls that struggle for mastery over the human psyche at the time of Atlantis were back for round two in his own age of ideology, financial collapse, and global war. Many are now among us. You know, and I think that's what the book ultimately turned into, you know, as a natural evolution as I was writing, was this is not just an obscure historical topic for a couple people. It's actually a story of the entire human race. If we can't learn from that, we probably are doomed to repeat those mistakes.
I think the Atlanteans were waiting for somebody who had the history in their mind and had been taught well enough to be able to connect the dots and tell their story the way they wanted it told. I think you've done that.
Wow. Well, I couldn't ask for a nicer compliment. Who knows? You know, who knows? At this point, this book has really changed my life because I view life very differently now in terms of my own journey, my concept of the afterlife or the before life, my concept of history. And it's kind of just put me at ease because I think I did this subconsciously as a kind of psychological, you know, therapy. And in the end, I was sitting around one day at my friend's ranch in northern Mexico where I live and talking to somebody. And I realized we were talking for 5 hours. And the person was like, "Have you written a book about this?" I said, "No, I just got some, you know, notes and something that I was kind of trying to figure out." And they said, "Are you crazy? Like, you have to finish this and put this out there. Like, I just listened to you for 5 hours and I came to the ranch to get a coffee. Like, you sold me." So it's been so nice to see the reception has been so tremendous from people that call me on or text me on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn and say, like, "You know, you really answered so many questions that I had. And, you know, I've never seen a book that really took seriously psychic phenomenon, but also was skeptical at the same time." Like, I think one of the greatest strengths of the book, according to the people that have sent me letters and things like this, was that, you know, I am legitimately fair. Like, I don't think every prediction ever Edgar Cayce said or made was 100% accurate. And he didn't either. Mm-hmm. You know, he always would say this. Like, he always can change. It doesn't mean that the earth changes are coming in 1998. He says, if you don't change anything, the human intention, his cosmology, has an effect on the earth resonance and therefore on the tectonic plates and volcanic activity, then this could happen. You know, like, yeah. Nostradamus, I think Dolores Cannon always said that, like, Nostradamus predicted worst case scenarios as a kind of like, "Hey, but I'm not even focused on predictions. I'm focused on past things that he was accurate about." And I was astounded. So it's really proven to me that, you know, the powers of the mind are vastly underrated and has really led me down this kind of alternate route where I don't study so much ancient history anymore or even really teach that. I'm more focused now on, you know, meeting people that are into refining these techniques of, you know, past life regressions or just what we would call, you know, what they call it stands for, the Department of Noetic Sciences, you know. Yeah. I got a nice message from Dean Radin, who is the head of that department, you know, who I cited in the book, and he's like, "Thank you." Like, he wrote a book called Real Magic that really opened my eyes to the potential and reality of remote viewing and clairvoyance and, you know, intention changing random number generators. And, you know, and again, this is science just as much as standard physics and chemistry is quote unquote science. Well, there's a science of the mind that has not been sufficiently explored for historical reasons and nothing less. Doesn't mean it's fake. It just means that we have chosen a paradigm that categorically rejects that, and that's it.
You said your social media, so LinkedIn and Twitter and Facebook, best ways to connect with you?
LinkedIn is probably the place I'm most active. And you could just type in Michael LaFlemme and you'll find me on LinkedIn. And if anybody's interested in, you know, past podcasts that I've done, you could just Google search Michael LaFlemme, Visions of Atlantis. And I've done 3 already with other authors on this subject and learned a lot myself, you know, just like I learned today from you about that tribe. So that's the name of the game, you know, because to me, this is like an ongoing, like, the book might be done, but to me, the search has just, you know, started. And it's not a search that ends with, you know, I mean, potentially could be a major archaeological discovery that I help, you know, bring light to. But it's really just a search of like, well, now that I know this is at least worthy of investigation, like, what else is out there, you know? And so it's been very cool to see how other people have approached this, you know, through the book has given me the reach to now meet other authors who, you know, themselves have gone on this journey and use their own sources and life experience. And that to me at the end, you know, was almost as fulfilling as, you know, selling a lot of copies of the book. I think that was just as cool to see other people process, you know, like a therapy group or something of historians that have been fighting this crazy trend in mainstream history to deny what is plainly in our face.
I want to say thank you too, because the dog ate our first interview and thoroughly destroyed it. So I appreciate round two. I think we covered some extra territory too. So I thank you. I appreciate that.
Sure. No, I appreciate you, Wendy. And thank you so much for your support and that tip. I'm definitely going to add that in a revised little note next week. So yeah, thank you. And again, I'm always open to, you know, collaborations, and I love talking to people that are interested in this. So hope to be back soon.
All right. And we're going to put links in the description for the show so you can follow those as well. And check out the book. It's available on Amazon, of course. Visions of Atlantis, Reclaiming Our Lost Ancient Legacy. Thank you for listening.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.